Part 2, Chapter 21. She stopped shyly at the railing and waited to get Judge Taylor's attention. She was in a fresh apron and she carried an envelope in her hand. Judge Taylor saw her and said, "It's Calpurnia, isn't it?" "Yes, sir," she said. "Could I just pass this note to Mr. Finch, please, sir? It hasn't got anything to do with the trial." Judge Taylor nodded and Atticus took the envelope from Calpurnia. He opened it, read its contents, and said, "Judge, this note is from my sister. She says my children are missing. Haven't turned up since noon. I know where they are, Atticus," Mr. Underwood spoke up. "They're right up yonder in the colored balcony. Been there since precisely 1:18 p.m. Our father turned around and looked up. "Jim, come down from there," he called. Then he said something to the judge we didn't hear. We climbed across Reverend Sykes and made our way to the staircase. Atticus and Calpurnia met us downstairs. Calpurnia looked peeved, but Atticus looked exhausted. Jim was jumping in excitement. "We've won, haven't we?" "I've no idea," said Atticus shortly. "You've been here all afternoon? Go home with Calpurnia and get your supper, and stay home." "Aw, Atticus, let us come back," pleaded Jim. "Please let us hear the verdict, please, sir." "The jury might be out and back in a minute, we don't know. But we could tell Atticus was relenting. Well, you've heard it all, so you might as well hear the rest. Tell you what, you can all come back when you've eaten your supper. Eat slowly now, you won't miss anything important. And if the jury's still out, you can wait with us. But I expect it'll be over before you get back." "You think they'll acquit him that fast?" asked Jim. Atticus opened his mouth to answer, but shut it and left us. I prayed that Reverend Sykes would save our seats for us, but stopped praying when I remembered that people got up and left in droves when the jury was out. Tonight, they'd overrun the drugstore, the OK Cafe, and the hotel. That is, unless they brought their suppers, too. Calpurnia marched us home. "Skin every one of you alive. The very idea. You children listening to all that? Mr. Jim, don't you know better than to take your little sister to that trial? Mix Alexandria will absolutely have a stroke of paralysis when she finds out. Ain't fitting for children to hear." The streetlights were on, and we glimpsed Calpurnia's indigent profile as we passed beneath them. "Mr. Jim, I thought you was getting some kind of head on your shoulders. The very idea. She's your little sister. The very idea, sir. You ought to be perfectly ashamed of yourself. Ain't you got any sense at all?" I was exhilarated. So many things had happened so fast I felt it would take years to sort them out. And now here was Calpurnia giving her precious Jim down the country. What new marvels would the evening bring? Jim was chuckling. "Don't you want to hear about it, Cal?" "Hush your mouth, sir. When you ought to be hanging your head in shame, you go along laughing." Calpurnia revived a series of rusty threats that moved Jim to little remorse, and she sailed up the front steps with her classic, "If Mr. Finch don't wear you out, I will. Get in that house, sir." Jim went in grinning, and Calpurnia nodded tacit consent to having Dylan to supper. "You all call Miss Rachel right now and tell her where you are," she told him. "She's run distracted looking for you. You watch out she doesn't ship you back to Meridian first thing in the morning." Aunt Alexandra met us and nearly fainted when Calpurnia told her where we were. I guess it hurt her when we told her Atticus said we could go back, because she didn't say a word during supper. She just rearranged food on her plate, looking at it sadly while Calpurnia served Jim, Dill, and me with a vengeance. Calpurnia poured milk, dished out potato salad and ham, muttering, "Shame to yourselves," in varying degrees of intensity. "Now you all eat slow," was her final command. Reverend Sykes had saved our places. We were surprised to find that we had been gone nearly an hour, and were equally surprised to find the courtroom exactly as we had left it, with minor changes. The jury box was empty, the defendant was gone, Judge Taylor had been gone, but he reappeared as we were seating ourselves. "Nobody's moved hardly," said Jim. "They moved around some when the jury went out," said Reverend Sykes. "The menfolk down there got the womenfolk their suppers and fed the babies." "How long have they been out?" asked Jim. "About 30 minutes. Mr. Finch and Mr. Gilmer did some more talking, and Judge Taylor charged the jury." "How was he?" asked Jim. "What say? Oh, he did right well. I ain't complaining one bit. He was mighty fair-minded. He sort of said, if you believe this, then you'll have to return one verdict, but if you believe this, you'll have to return another one. I thought he was leaning a little to our side." Reverend Sykes scratched his head. Jim smiled. "He's not supposed to lean, Reverend, but don't fret. We've won it," he said wisely. "Don't see how any jury could convict on what we heard." "Now don't you be so confident, Mr. Jim. I ain't ever seen any jury decide in favor of a colored man over a white man." But Jim took exception to Reverend Sykes, and we were subjected to a lengthy review of the evidence with Jim's ideas on the law regarding rape. It wasn't rape if she let you, but she had to be 18, in Alabama that is, and Mayella was 19. Apparently you had to kick and holler, you had to be overpowered and stomped on, preferably knocked stone cold. If you were under 18, you didn't have to go through all this. "Mr. Jim," Reverend Sykes demurred, "this ain't a polite thing for little ladies to hear." "Aw, she doesn't know what we're talking about," said Jim. "Scout, this is too old for you, ain't it?" "It most certainly is not. I know every word you're saying." Perhaps I was too convincing because Jim hushed and never discussed the subject again. "What time is it, Reverend?" he asked. "Getting on toward 8. I looked down and saw Atticus strolling around with his hands in his pockets. He made a tour of the windows, then walked by the railing over to the jury box. He looked in it, inspected Judge Taylor on his throne, then went back to where he started. I caught his eye and waved to him. He acknowledged my salute with a nod and resumed his tour. Mr. Gilmer was standing at the windows talking to Mr. Underwood. Bert, the court reporter, was chain-smoking. He sat back with his feet on the table. But the officers of the court, the ones present, Atticus, Mr. Gilmer, Judge Taylor, sound asleep, and Bert, were the only ones whose behavior seemed normal. I had never seen a packed courtroom so still. Sometimes a baby would cry out fretfully and a child would scurry out, but the grown people sat as if they were in church. In the balcony, the Negroes sat and stood around us with biblical patience. The old courthouse clock suffered its preliminary strain and struck the hour, 8 deafening bongs that shook our bones. When it bonged 11 times, I was past feeling. Tired from fighting sleep, I allowed myself a short nap against Reverend Sykes' comfortable arm and shoulder. I jerked awake and made an honest effort to remain so by looking down and concentrating on the heads below. There were 16 bald ones, 14 men that could pass for redheads, 40 heads varying between brown and black, and I remembered something Jim had once explained to me when he went through a brief period of psychological research. He said if enough people, a stadium full maybe, were to concentrate on one thing, such as setting a tree afire in the woods, that the tree would ignite of its own accord. I toyed with the idea of asking everyone below to concentrate on setting Tom Robinson free, but thought if they were as tired as I, it wouldn't work. Dill was sound asleep, his head on Jim's shoulder, and Jim was quiet. "Ain't it a long time?" I asked him. "Sure is, Scout," he said happily. "Well, from the way you put it, it'd just take 5 minutes." Jim raised his eyebrows. "There are things you don't understand," he said, and I was too weary to argue. But I must have been reasonably awake, or I would not have received the impression that was creeping into me. It was not unlike one I had last winter, and I shivered, though the night was hot. The feeling grew until the atmosphere in the courtroom was exactly the same as a cold February morning, when the mockingbirds were still, and the carpenters had stopped hammering on Miss Maudie's new house, and every wood door in the neighborhood was shut as tight as the doors of the Radley place. A deserted, waiting, empty street, and the courtroom was packed with people. A steaming summer night was no different from a winter morning. Mr. Heck Tate, who had entered the courtroom and was talking to Atticus, might have been wearing his high boots and lumber jacket. Atticus had stopped his tranquil journey and had put his foot on the bottom rung of a chair as he listened to what Mr. Tate was saying. He ran his hand slowly up and down his thigh. I expected Mr. Tate to say any minute, "Take him, Mr. Finch." But Mr. Tate said, "This court will come to order," in a voice that rang with authority, and the heads below us jerked up. Mr. Tate left the room and returned with Tom Robinson. He steered Tom to his place beside Atticus and stood there. Judge Taylor had roused himself to sudden alertness and was sitting up straight looking at the empty jury box. What happened after that had a dreamlike quality. In a dream, I saw the jury return moving like underwater swimmers, and Judge Taylor's voice came from far away and was tiny. I saw something only a lawyer's child could be expected to see, could be expected to watch for, and it was like watching Atticus walk into the street, raise a rifle to his shoulder, and pull the trigger, but watching all the time knowing the gun was empty. A jury never looks at a defendant it has convicted. And when this jury came in, not one of them looked at Tom Robinson. The foreman handed a piece of paper to Mr. Tate, who handed it to the clerk, who handed it to the judge. I shut my eyes. Judge Taylor was polling the jury. Guilty, 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 guilty. I peeked at Jim. His hands were white from gripping the balcony rail, and his shoulders jerked as if each guilty was a separate stab between them. Judge Taylor was saying something. His gavel was in his fist, but he wasn't using it. Dimly, I saw Atticus pushing papers from the table into his briefcase. He snapped it shut, went to the court reporter, and said something. Nodded to Mr. Gilmer, and then went to Tom Robinson and whispered something to him. Atticus put his hand on Tom's shoulder as he whispered. Atticus took his coat off the back of his chair and pulled it over his shoulder. Then he left the courtroom, but not by his usual exit. He must have wanted to go home the short way because he walked quickly down the middle aisle toward the south exit. I followed the top of his head as he made his way to the door. He did not look up. Someone was punching me, but I was reluctant to take my eyes from the people below us and from the image of Atticus's lonely walk down the aisle. "Miss Jean Louise?" I looked around. They were standing. All around us in the balcony on the opposite wall, the Negroes were getting to their feet. Reverend Sykes' voice was as distant as Judge Taylor's. "Miss Jean Louise, stand up. Your father's passing." Chapter 22. It was Jim's turn to cry. His face was streaked with angry tears as we made our way through the cheerful crowd. "It ain't right," he muttered, all the way to the corner of the square where we found Atticus waiting. Atticus was standing under the streetlight looking as though nothing had happened. His vest was buttoned, his collar and tie were neatly in place, his watch chain glistened, and he was his impassive self again. "It ain't right, Atticus," said Jim. "No, son, it's not right." We walked home. Aunt Alexandra was waiting up. She was in her dressing gown, and I could have sworn she had on her corset underneath it. "I'm sorry, brother," she murmured. Having never heard her call Atticus brother before, I stole a glance at Jim, but he was not listening. He would look up at Atticus, then down at the floor, and I wondered if he thought Atticus somehow responsible for Tom Robinson's conviction. "Is he all right?" Auntie asked, indicating Jim. "He'll be so presently," said Atticus. It was a little too strong for him, our father sighed. "I'm going to bed," he said. "If I don't wake up in the morning, don't call me." I didn't think it was wise in the first place to let them. "This is their home, sister," said Atticus. "We've made it this way for them, and they might as well learn to cope with it." "But they don't have to go to the courthouse and wallow in it. It's just as much Macomb County as Missionary Tees." "Atticus!" Aunt Alexander's eyes were anxious. "You are the last person I thought would turn bitter over this." "I'm not bitter, just tired. I'm going to bed." "Atticus," said Jim bleakly. He turned in the doorway. "What, son?" "How could they do it? How could they?" "I don't know, but they did it. They've done it before, and they did it tonight, and they'll do it again, and when they do it, seems that only children weep. Good night." But things are always better in the morning. Atticus rose at his usual ungodly hour and was in the living room behind the mobile register when we stumbled in. Jim's morning face posed the question his sleepy lips struggled to ask. "It's not time to worry yet," Atticus reassured him as we went into the dining room. "We're not through yet. There'll be an appeal, you can count on that. Gracious alive, Cal, what's all this?" He was staring at his breakfast plate. Calpurnia said, "Tom Robinson's daddy sent you along this chicken this morning, and I fixed it." "You tell him I'm proud to get it. Bet they don't have chicken for breakfast at the White House. What are these?" "Rolls," said Calpurnia. "Estelle down at the hotel sent them." Atticus looked at her puzzled, and she said, "You better step out here and see what's in the kitchen, Mr. Finch." We followed him. The kitchen table was loaded with enough food to bury the family, hunks of salt pork, tomatoes, beans, even scuppernogs. Atticus grinned when he found a jar of pickled pig's knuckles. "Reckon Auntie will let me eat these in the dining room?" Calpurnia said, "This was all around the back steps when I got here this morning. They appreciate what you did, Mr. Finch. They aren't overstepping themselves, are they?" Atticus's eyes filled with tears. He did not speak for a moment. "Tell them I'm very grateful," he said. Tell them they must never do this again. Times are too hard." He left the kitchen, went in the dining room, and excused himself to Aunt Alexandra, put on his hat, and went to town. We heard Dill's step in the hall, so Calpurnia left Atticus's uneaten breakfast on the table. Between rabbit bites, Dill told us of Miss Rachel's reaction to last night, which was, "If a man like Atticus Finch wants to bust his head against a stone wall, it's his head." I'd got her told, growled Dill, gnawing a chicken leg, "but she didn't look much like telling this morning. Said she was up half the night wondering where I was. Said she'd had the sheriff after me, but he was at the hearing." "Dill, you gotta stop going off without telling her," said Jim. "It just aggravates her." Dill sighed patiently. "I told her till I was blue in the face where I was going. She's just seeing too many snakes in the closet. Bet that woman drinks a pint for breakfast every morning. No, she drinks two glasses full. Seen her." "Don't talk like that, Dill," said Aunt Alexandra. "It's not becoming to a child. It's cynical." "I ain't cynical, Miss Alexandra. Tell him the truth's not cynical, is it?" "The way you tell it, it is." Jim's eyes flashed at her, but he said to Dill, "Let's go. You can take that runner with you." When we went to the front porch, Miss Stephanie Crawford was busy telling it to Miss Maudie Atkinson and Mr. Avery. They looked around at us and went on talking. Jim made a feral noise in his throat. I wished for a weapon. "I hate grown folks looking at you," said Dill. "Makes you feel like you've done something." Miss Maudie yelled for Jim Finch to come there. Jim groaned and heaved himself up from the swing. "We'll go with you," Dill said. Miss Stephanie's nose quivered with curiosity. She wanted to know who all gave us permission to go to court. She didn't see us, but it was all over town this morning that we were in the colored balcony. Did Atticus put us up there as a sort of... Wasn't it right close up there with all those... Did Scout understand all the... Didn't it make us mad to see our daddy beat? "Hush, Stephanie." Miss Maudie's dictation was deadly. "I've not got all the morning to pass on the porch. Jim Finch, I called to find out if you and your colleagues can eat some cake. Got up at 5 to make it, so you better say yes. Excuse us, Stephanie. Good morning, Mr. Avery." There was a big cake and two little ones on Miss Maudie's kitchen table. There should have been three little ones. It was not like Miss Maudie to forget Dill, and we must have shown it. But we understood when she cut from the big cake and gave the slice to Jim. As we ate, we sensed that this was Miss Maudie's way of saying that as far as she was concerned, nothing had changed. She sat quietly in a kitchen chair watching us. Suddenly, she spoke. Don't fret, Jim. Things are never as bad as they seem. Indoors, when Miss Maudie wanted to say something lengthy, she spread her fingers on her knees and settled her bridge work. This she did, and we waited. I simply want to tell you that there are some men in the world who were born to do unpleasant jobs for us. Your father's one of them.
Oh, said Jim. Well,
don't you oh well me, sir, Miss Maudie replied, recognizing Jim's noises. You are not old enough to appreciate what I said. Jim was staring at his half-eaten cake. It's like being a caterpillar in a cocoon, that's what it is, he said. Like something's asleep, wrapped up in a warm place. I always thought Macomb folks were the best folks in the world. At least that's what they seemed like. We're the safest folks in the world, said Miss Maudie. We're so rarely called on to be Christians, but when we are, we've got men like Atticus to go for us. Jim grinned ruefully. Wish the rest of the county thought that. You'd be surprised how many of us do. Who, Jim's voice rose, who in this town did one thing to help Tom Robinson? Just who? His colored friends, for one thing, and people like us, people like Judge Taylor, people like Mr. Heck Tate. Stop eating and start thinking, Jim. Did it ever strike you that Judge Taylor naming Atticus to defend that boy was no accident? That Judge Taylor might have had his reasons for naming him? That was a thought. Court-appointed defenses were usually given to Maxwell Green, Macomb's latest addition to the bar, who needed the experience. Maxwell Green should have had Tom Robinson's case. You think about that, Miss Maudie was saying. It was no accident. I was sitting there on the porch last night waiting. I waited and waited to see you all come down the sidewalk. And as I waited, I thought, Atticus Finch won't win. He can't win, but he's the only man in these parts who can keep a jury out so long in a case like that. And I thought to myself, well, we're making a step. It's just a baby step, but it's a step. It's all right to talk like that. Can't any Christian judges and lawyers make up for heathen juries, Jim muttered. Soon as I get grown, that's something you'll have to take up with your father, Miss Maudie said. We went down Miss Maudie's cool steps into the sunshine and found Mr. Avery and Miss Stephanie Crawford still at it. They had moved down the sidewalk and were standing in front of Miss Stephanie's house. Miss Rachel was walking toward them. I think I'll be a clown when I get grown, said Dill. Jim and I stopped in our tracks. Yes, sir, a clown, he said. There ain't one thing in this world I can do except make folks laugh, so I'm going to join the circus and laugh my head off. You got it backwards, Dill, said Jim. Clowns are sad. It's folks that laugh at them. Well, I'm going to be a new kind of clown. I'm just going to stand in the middle of the ring and laugh at the folks. Just look a yonder, he pointed. Every one of them ought to be riding broomsticks. Aunt Rachel already does. Miss Stephanie and Miss Rachel were waving wildly at us in a way that did not give lie to Dill's observation. Oh, gosh, breathed Jim. I reckon it'd be ugly not to see him. Something was wrong. Mr. Avery was red in the face from a sneezing spell and nearly blew us off the sidewalk when we came up. Miss Stephanie was trembling with excitement, and Miss Rachel caught Dill's shoulder. You get on in the backyard and stay there, she said. There's danger a-coming. What's the matter? I asked. Ain't you heard yet? It's all over town. At that moment, Aunt Alexander came to the door and called us, but she was too late. It was Miss Stephanie's pleasure to tell us this morning. Mr. Bob Ewell stopped Atticus on the post office corner, spat in his face, and told him he'd get him if it took the rest of his life. Thanks for listening to these chapters. Please hit that red subscribe button down below or just click on that picture up above so that I can make more of these audiobooks.